So this, I believe that according to the program, that I'm still going to give two more talks as well as this one today. So for the afternoon talk, I'm going to be using that one to talk about how to use this meditation and how to use the Dhamma when you go back home and how to carry on your practice. So I'm going to leave those subjects to later on this afternoon, which also means that in your interviews, those people coming for an interview this morning, if you ask the question of, well, what should I do when I get home, how can I continue this practice, much of that will be covered this afternoon in the talk between 3 and 4 o'clock, I believe. So, at the moment, I wanted to just tie up a few ends about meditation, and in particular, cover a subject which I hadn't really talked about yet, which is other types of meditation and how we can use other methods of meditation alongside with our main practice. One of the first things I wanted to say, that there's a very beautiful sutta. I was trying to find it this morning, but I couldn't find it in the library. And one of the best translations was done by a Norwegian scholar, Johansson. And his translation titled that sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya by the Buddha, that enlightenment is a natural process. That's what he called the sutta. And it's an interesting, fascinating one to mention, because it shows a whole process of stages by which enlightenment happens. And at each of these stages, the Buddha made quite clear that this is a natural, automatic process, that you really don't have to get involved at all. It just happens. It is a process which I've alluded to before, but haven't really gone into detail. It starts in many different places in the Pali Sutras. This particular one starts with the arising of faith. Once there is an arising of faith, the Buddha said, it is automatic, one doesn't need to think, to make an aspiration, that once I have faith, may delight appear in my mind. Because he said it's natural, it happens automatically. In one who has faith, they get delight in the Dhamma. That delight in the Dhamma is the word called pamuja. It means you're rejoicing in what's being said. It's the same when you hear a good Dhamma discourse, you think, oh, that makes sense, and you feel happiness as a result of what you have heard. And that's the start of the sequence. From faith, we get this delight. And the Buddha continues to say, in one who has delight, you do not need to make an aspiration just to decide, oh, may I now experience joy. He says it's a natural consequence of delight that you will experience joy, which in the Pali is the word piti. You don't have to make an aspiration. It happens automatically. So from sadda, from faith, we got delight. From delight, we got joy. Now the next stage is interesting. He said, so for one who has joy, they do not need to make an aspiration. They do not need to think, to will, to choose. Oh, may my body be tranquil. Tranquility happens as a natural result of joy in the mind. Now that tranquility of the body is that stage when you can sit in your body effortlessly, without any pain, without needing to move, without needing to scratch. It is that effortless tranquility of the body which many of you have come across in your meditation. It's the state where the body is the most comfortable. Now, even though you're sitting reasonably still, you are not really comfortable. There's always an ache or an itch. It's too hot, it's too cold. There's always some irritation in this body, even if it's only having to move the eyelids to keep the eyes watered. I've mentioned that irritation of the body before. This is what keeps you from being tranquil in the body. There comes a stage in the meditation, and many of you have reached that stage and gone much deeper, where you're sitting there and the body is still. You don't have to move it. Your eyes are closed, so you don't have to move your eyelids. You don't have to scratch your nose. You don't have to do anything. The body is at peace. You haven't quite left the body yet, but you're so close to leaving the body. The body is just sitting there. You're happy. You're at peace. It's that feeling where you can sit, you feel you can sit for long periods of time. There's no effort anymore. It's not like when you first meditate, you sit down and there's always some discomfort there. The tranquility we're talking about here is when the body can be put in its position and you don't have to move it. It sits there absolutely still all by itself. It sits still because you've taken your attention away from it. Your attention is placed elsewhere. When you don't put your attention on the body, you just become oblivious. You don't receive the aches and itches around your body. That state of tranquility of the body is one of the great successes of meditation. You feel so happy and so at peace, simply because you don't have to worry with this body anymore. The Buddha said, for one who has such tranquility of body, they don't need to make a resolution to decide, oh, may I experience happiness, sukha. He said it's natural that anyone who has tranquility of body, when the body is still, that sukha, happiness, will come as a natural result. And I've already mentioned that the fact that you don't have to move that body, there's so little you need to do anymore, means that the energy can go into mindfulness, and energy in mindfulness is called happiness. You don't do anything. You don't need to do anything. It happens as a natural course that in one who is tranquil, they experience happiness. Now this is a happiness which I've mentioned before. It's not the sort of happiness you get when you eat your favorite food. It's not the happiness you get when you meet a relation who's just come from overseas. It's not the happiness you get when you see your favorite movie on TV. This is a different type of happiness, a more refined happiness, a happiness born of tranquility. But that happiness comes. And it's good to know that happiness coming from tranquility of the body. The point is that you don't need to do anything. The Buddha said it happens as a natural course. And the next stage is, the Buddha said, in one who is happy, they don't need to make an effort of will. They don't need to determine, oh, may my mind enter samadhi. He said it happens naturally, as a natural course, automatically, that in one who is happy, their mind enters samadhi. Now I've been trying to teach this all the last 9 days. If you could only let go, you find that this process of tranquility leading to happiness, leading to samadhi, happens automatically, all by itself. Some of you who experience that, when you get out of the way and let this automatic process occur, it happens so easily, so effortlessly, and you get into states of samadhi. This is a natural process. It's usually when the will gets involved by trying, or what we call craving, that's what interrupts the process and stops people getting into deep samadhi. For those who are enlightened beings, or on the way to enlightenment, because their craving has been mostly overcome, even for a stream winner, the craving has been greatly weakened, it means that the path into samadhi is that much easier. And the reason is because they don't interrupt the natural process. They are more able to let go. They've got less craving, they can let go more, and they can allow the natural process of samadhi to happen. So the Buddha said, for one who is happy, you don't need to make that resolution, oh, may I enter samadhi, may I gain the jhanas. It happens naturally. Can't stop it. Or rather, you can stop it. If you get involved, you do stop it. You get you out of the way, and the process just happens. I hope that many of you have got some inkling in how that works. You will find in this retreat your best meditations have always happened effortlessly when you get out of the way, when you don't try to do anything. You just sit there, and sometimes in the most unexpected times, you just sit there and it happens. And you wonder, I didn't do anything. Why did that happen? Every time I try, I really put forth effort, it never happens, of course. Because you've been interfering with what is a natural process. The next stages are even more interesting. The Buddha said, in one who gains samadhi, they don't need to make an effort of will. They do not need to decide, oh, may I see things as they truly are. May I get insight. It happens as a natural course. You can't stop it, the Buddha said. This is a Buddha's teaching. That in one who has samadhi, they see things as they truly are. This is the Buddha's word for insight. He called it Yathābhūta Jñāna-dasana. Yathābhūta Jñāna-dasana. Yathābhūta as they are, Jñāna-dasana, seeing deeply with insight. This is seeing things not as you want them to be, but seeing things as they truly are. The word actually vipassana doesn't really stand for the insights which come. It stands for the process by which insights arise. Such as like samatha doesn't describe the jhanas. Samatha describes the process by which one enters a jhana. The jhanas are called samadhi. Samatha is the path into samadhi. Vipassana is a practice into insight. And this is all the one and the same thing. For one who has samadhi, naturally, automatically, without an effort of will, you see things as they truly are, which is insight. From this point on, an unfolding, an untying process happens. For one who sees things as they truly are, they don't need to make an effort of will. They don't need to try. Oh, may repulsion to the world arise. Naturally, they're not interested in the things of the world. They don't need to make an effort to renounce. The renouncing happens as part of the natural process. You can neither initiate it nor stop it. Those things in the past which fascinated you now don't interest you anymore. Just like the person who was a young girl played with her little dolls, or the boy with his teddy bear. When you get up, you're not interested in such things anymore. In one who has such repulsion, it's like a repelling force. When you, I call repulsion, this nibbida, samsara's ejection seat. It's like samsara, you're in this plane. And you do need something to take you out of samsara. This nibbida is the ejection seat of nibbana. Once you press the seeing things as they truly are button, then you get ejected out of samsara, whether you like it or not. In fact, it's not up to you, it's a natural process. In one who sees things as they truly are, they get ejected out of samsara. In one who gets ejected out of samsara, who experiences repulsion, this nibbida, then the things begin to fade. It's called viraga, sometimes called dispassion. It means that the things in the world which they always were concerned about, their attachments and their cravings, they tend to fade away from their life. They're no longer concerns of you anymore. Because they're no longer concerns, they disappear from your consciousness. The disappearing is called nirodha. In one who experiences this dispassion, they'll experience cessation. They don't need to make an effort of will. It happens automatically. In one who experiences cessation, they're the ones who experience freedom, liberation from samsara, arahant. This beautiful sutta shows just how this is a natural process for all human beings. It's just like a flower which is growing and then blossoming and then blooming. You don't have to do anything. It just happens automatically. It's like Ajahn Chah used to say when I was first in his monastery in Wat Pa Phong in Thailand. He said, I've planted the mango garden. All you monks don't need to do anything. Just have to wait for the mangoes to fall. That's what Ajahn Chah used to say. I never really understood what he meant at the time. Obviously, now you understand what he meant. What he meant was, this process is natural. As you get on this path, starting with someone like faith, it unfolds in its natural course. And the only way that you can lengthen its time is actually to keep interfering with it. It's like that simile I gave a few days ago of a person who puts a bandage on a cut on their finger. They put that bandage or that band-aid on the cut. If they would only leave that band-aid alone, the wound would heal very well, because it's a natural process of healing. But what many people do once they put a band-aid on their cut finger, they lift up the band-aid after 5 minutes to see how it's going. And then they put the band-aid back again. Another 2 minutes go past, they lift it up again to put some ointment on, and then they put it down again. Then they decide it's the wrong ointment, so they take it off and they put some other ointment on. They're always interfering with the natural processes of the body's healing, in the same way that it's too easy to interfere with the natural processes of our meditation. That's why this letting go, this being content, this compassion, the door of my heart's open to this moment, no matter what it is. That degree of letting go, of getting out of the way and allowing the process to happen, is how we meditate. If that's all you've really understood in this retreat, that's amazing. You've gained one of the precious gifts. You've got the key to liberation. This path, as I've been saying, goes in an opposite direction to the way of the world. In the way of the world, if you want something, you've got to work hard for it. You've got to strive, reach out and grasp it. Otherwise, somebody else gets it before you. Here, in this meditation practice, it's in a completely opposite direction. Instead of reaching out, which is going out into the world, we let go and allow the mind to go in. It's not craving. It's going the opposite direction. Going inwards, not outwards. Going inwards means going into where you are now. You don't go on to something else. Many of you are already going on to later on this afternoon, this evening, when you finish this retreat. You're already planning what's going to happen in the future. We're going on, and much of our life's always planning what we're going to do next. We're always on the run in this world we call samsara. We never stop to see what's happening now. All those talks which I've given about contentment, when I've talked about just a Monday morning in my monastery, just walking around, not looking about what needs to be done later on, but to looking what's already there, what's perfect already. This is the way of meditation. Stopping a while in your life. Stopping and allowing the process to unfold. The natural process of enlightenment. Because it was a natural process, that's why many people from all walks of life, whether they were kings or prostitutes, men, women, intelligent or hardly any education at all, why many people would gain that enlightenment really easy. It happened because they got out of the way and they let it happen. One of the stories I always tell at this time of the retreat is of a nun, one of my heroes in the time of the Buddha. This nun was called Siha. Her verses later became included in what's called the Therigata. Therigata, sorry. These are the verses of the enlightened nuns of the time of the Buddha. If any of you want some inspiration and some idea about what monastic life truly is and how ordinary people became enlightened, it's inspiring to read these verses, these poems, written by monks and nuns who were enlightened at the time of the Buddha or just after. They are poems, very often that monks or nuns, after their enlightenment, were so inspired, or they were asked by others to describe their life and how they became enlightened and what they were doing and how that worked. And some of those stories are extremely interesting. Number one, it shows you that even you can become enlightened, because these were just ordinary people. They weren't special in any which way. And number two, it shows you what happened. This particular story, Siha, she was a nun for 7 years in a monastery at the time of the Buddha. She had the best teachers, she had the best opportunities, but after 7 years, never once did she experience any peace of mind. Now some of you can imagine what it's like after 9 days if you've never experienced any tranquility. You'd be pretty fed up with this retreat. You'd probably go back either blaming me or blaming the organizers or blaming someone. But this was a nun who went much further than 9 days. She went 7 whole years, and never once could her meditation gain any peace. Never once did she have any understanding. She really gave it everything she got. So after 7 years, she realized that she just can't do this. But she did not want to go back home. She did not want to go back into lay life. So she did the only thing she could do. She got hold of a long length of rope. Taking that rope, she entered the forest. She climbed up a tree to tie one end of the rope to a branch, and then she tied the other end of the rope around her neck. She prepared to jump off and hang herself, but just before she jumped off, she became fully enlightened. That was pretty touch and go. And if you haven't got enlightened yet, we can get you some legs of rope. Please do not do that, otherwise I get a bad reputation. But it's a fascinating story that there was a nun who had been practicing so hard, keeping her precepts, meditating under the best of teachers, but still couldn't get anywhere. She thought that she was light years from enlightenment. But then what happened? She tied a rope to a tree, the other to her neck. She was about to jump off. Her mind let go. She gave up trying. That's how enlightenment happens. One of my similes, which is not from the Theragata, this is an original Ajahn Brahm simile, is how the donkey catches the carrot. Many of you may have been to Southern Europe. I'm not sure whether they still have donkey carts in Southern Europe. Sometimes they still keep them for the tourists. But until quite recently, all transport was done in a donkey cart, tying a donkey to the front, the cart in the back, and the owner of the cart would get up on the front and urge the donkey on. And that cart would carry people, it would carry vegetables, anything. They did not have automotive transport in those days, especially in the poor parts of Southern Europe. So the most common form of transport was a donkey cart. And I think that if you've never seen a donkey, you all know that donkeys are the most stubborn of animals. They just will not move. If you try and urge them, then they dig their heels in and they will not move for anything. Even if they get hit, they won't move. They're such stubborn creatures. However, the way that they make the donkey move in Southern Europe is to attach a stick to the cart. That stick is longer than the donkey. It extends just over the donkey's head, maybe a foot or two in front. On the end of that stick, they tie a string. On the other end of the string, they tie a juicy carrot. So the carrot dangles maybe a couple of feet in front of the donkey's nose. So the donkey, because of craving, because of desire for that lovely juicy carrot, moves its head towards the carrot to try and eat it. As it moves its head, so its body moves also. As the body moves, it pulls a cart. As the cart moves, so does the carrot move, always keeping ahead of the donkey. So the donkey walks trying to get the carrot, but the carrot, moving with the cart, is always 2 feet away. That's how they get the donkeys to pull the carts. It's donkey psychology. Of course, that donkey will never get that carrot. Even if it runs fast, that carrot will run just as fast in front of it, always 1 or 2 feet in front. But, I'm not sure if it was because I was a donkey in the past, but I figured out how Buddhist donkeys catch the carrot. If you were a Buddhist donkey and knew about meditation and had wisdom, you would know it's that easy, so easy to catch the carrot. What the Buddhist donkey does is start running after that carrot, running as fast as it possibly can, chasing that carrot. Even though the carrot moves just as fast in front of that donkey, even at top speed, the carrot also moves at the same top speed. Now that's an ordinary donkey. What makes that donkey a wise Buddhist donkey is the donkey knows how to stop. Then the donkey suddenly stops, puts on the brakes and comes to a sudden halt. When it comes to a sudden halt, that carrot, because of momentum, moves even further away from the donkey. But the donkey has faith. It has patience. It knows what's going to happen next. That carrot moves even further away from the donkey than it's ever been, ever before. Before it's only been 2 feet away. Now it's 4 feet away, high above its head, on the end of the trajectory. But the donkey doesn't get afraid. The donkey doesn't despair. Oh, it looks like enlightenment is even further away from me than ever. Because the donkey knows what's going to happen next. The donkey doesn't do anything. Even though the carrot seems to be going further and further away, the donkey just waits. It lets go. It stops still. It's patient. And what happens next is the carrot goes to the very extremity of its swing, stops, and slowly starts to come back towards the donkey. And the donkey just looks at that with appreciation and knowledge. There is the Dharma happening. Now the carrot is coming towards him. Soon the carrot is back to its original position, about 2 feet in front. But now it's not dangling. It's rushing towards him at top speed. And the donkey just smiles. And at the right moment says, "Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you." It opens its mouth. And the carrot comes in all by itself. That's how Buddhist donkeys capture carrots. And I think it's the reason why, as Buddhism spreads to Europe, they don't have donkey carts anymore. I think all the donkeys are now Buddhists, and they know the trick of how to catch the carrot. Now, do you understand that simile? We all go chasing happiness and craving, which is the carrot which we want. We go chasing it, and some of you chase it very, very hard. You are incredibly determined, motivated, hard workers. You race at top speed in Penang, chasing a carrot. And for this retreat, some of you have got the message. You have been chasing at top speed. Now you stop. As soon as you stop on this retreat, that carrot gets even further away. You get dozy. You go to sleep. The hindrances are very strong. You think, "My goodness, I should be chasing that carrot again." Ajahn Brahm says, "Go and take a rest." Ajahn Brahm says, "Sleep as much as you like." "My goodness, that's not chasing the carrot. Look, the carrot's going even further away from me." That's how it feels, isn't it? First couple of days of the retreat. You think you're never going to get enlightened this way. The first couple of days you've had better meditation at home. Now you're just spending all the time dozing and sleeping. But you remember the instructions, you've stopped. And you're patient. Enlightenment goes even further away from you the first couple of days in the retreat. It goes so far away, you think you're the most hopeless case ever. But you wait. You don't do anything. If you go chasing that carrot again, it won't work. You just wait. And then in the middle of the retreat, you see the carrot come towards you. You see happiness, joy, samadhi, jhanas, enlightenment start coming towards you. You're not doing anything. Happiness, joy, mindfulness, insights, they just come flooding into the mind. And soon the enlightenment gets so the carrot is going so fast towards you. You can't stop. You get all these amazing experiences of joy and power and energy. That carrot is coming faster than ever before, but this time in your direction. And all you have to do, just at the right moment, is say, "The door of my mouth is open to enlightenment." Just open your mouth. That's the only effort you need to do. Open your mind. Not closing the mind, open it. Loving kindness, freedom. And enlightenment comes in all by itself. Oh, that's delicious. That's the story of the donkey and the carrot and how enlightenment actually happens. That's exactly the same story as the Buddha told, which I just described earlier about enlightenment being a natural process. I just gave it a different twist. The donkey and the carrot. So this is how we do this enlightenment. This is why we meditate. And once you understand that whole process, all the other types of meditation which are taught in the world, all the other focuses of mindfulness which you can practice, whether it's walking meditation, loving kindness meditation, death meditation, body meditation, it all starts to make sense. It all starts to fit as a whole practice, which is why we call this the holy life. It's a whole, and not sort of different parts to it. One practice, one way, maybe different aspects, but all the same superhighway into nirvana. As we understand that, we understand how to do walking meditation. We do walking meditation to let go, that's all. We don't do walking meditation to get anywhere, which is one of the wonderful things about walking meditation. We go backwards and forwards, and we get nowhere. That's wonderful. That's what we're supposed to be doing in walking meditation. If you don't want to go walking meditation backwards and forwards, walk in a circle. That's even better. It shows you wherever you start, you come back there afterwards. You don't meditate to get somewhere. You meditate to stay where you are and go deeper into where you are. In one's walking meditation, same thing. Go into the center of now. Go into the center of silence. Be able to be aware of the movement of the feet. It's good to do things like walking meditation because you can't always be with your breath. And what you're training to do in walking meditation is to put your mindfulness where it's needed. Some people have asked me, in walking meditation, should you be focusing on your breath? I say, no, please don't do that. If you focus on your breath when you're doing the walking, sometimes your focus on the breath can be so complete, you have full awareness on the breath, you forget your feet altogether, and you end up bumping into the wall. You may even fall down the stairs. Goodness knows what might happen to you. So to make sure that myself and this organization committee aren't sued for malfeasance, for injuring you, stopping your career, we make sure that you put your attention where it's needed. It's like the person even doing walking meditation crossing the street. They should not be aware of their feet when they're crossing the street. They should be aware of the cars, for goodness sake. Not just lifting, lifting, lifting. So cars coming, that's what you should be aware of. Now, when you're driving your car, don't watch your breath, watch the traffic lights. We have to do this. I was told there is one monk, I haven't seen him, but there's one monk in Thailand who's got such deep meditation that when he does the walking meditation, he just slips into jhana. He actually does get into those absorptions when his awareness of his body completely disappears. And in his jhana while walking, he's the only monk I've heard about who can do that. He keeps bumping into trees. It's full of scratches and bruises over his face. It's not a good thing to do. So when you're walking, just make sure your attention is on the walking. And when you're eating as well, be only eating. A good practice, I should have told you this earlier, but when you're doing eating meditation, see if you can just eat one spoon at a time. What the one spoon practice means is when you're lifting up the spoon, very often before it's even got to your mouth, you're looking down to see what you're going to put next on your spoon. Quite often, even before it's in your mouth, you're always about two or three spoonfuls in front of yourself. Now here, one spoon at a time meditation means you take a spoon of food, you put it in your mouth, you eat it, swallow it, and only then do you think about the next spoon. Sometimes, I've seen people do this, they've got a spoon of food, they've got a piece of food in their spoon, they put it in their mouth, and there's another one waiting, patiently waiting to get in there. Now that is not real mindfulness, is it? That's always one or two steps in front. So one spoon at a time, and one. How can you really be enjoying the food you're eating now if you're trying to choose what you're going to eat next? Your mind's not really there in what's going on. So try one spoon at a time when you're doing your eating practice. You'll find it's more enjoyable. You get more taste out of the food. And you're not always going off into the future like so often we do. Always one or two steps ahead of ourselves. Always thinking, what am I going to do after this meditation? What am I going to do after this retreat? What am I going to do after I finish work? What am I going to do after my holidays are finished? Always after, 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 after. Never really here. So that's walking meditation. We just learn how to be present, not going anywhere. Just being here. I used to get very stood in walking meditation. When you walk meditation, it doesn't matter how fast or how slow you walk. Like anything else, you allow it to be natural. You, what the body wants to do. Sometimes, because I'm a monk who has to give many talks, and people don't allow me to have exercise, sometimes I say, oh, I'll walk over there to, you know, that house for Dharana. They say, no, we've got to pick you up. So I need the exercise. No, we need the merit. And you always win, I lose. So it's very hard to get exercise as a monk. Even if I try and do some sweeping, someone comes up and says, no, Ajahn Brahm, I'll do that. It's so hard. So sometimes I do fast walking, just to get some exercise, to get the body going. And fast walking is just my body feels like it really wants to do some exercise, something sort of energetic. So fast walking is fine. Sometimes I do that. But sometimes I do slow walking as well. Sometimes I do extremely slow walking. But it happens naturally. I remember this one occasion. It was only my first month, I think, as a monk in this monastery in Bangkok. And I was doing walking meditation outside the main hall. The hall was maybe about as big as this room over here. And they had a grandfather clock in that hall. So I could actually realize that it took me half an hour to walk from one end to the next. And half an hour back again. Like the 1 hour walking period was just going up once and back once. I didn't force myself to do that, it just became natural. And the reason was that after a while there was just so much going on in my feet as I was moving that I couldn't go fast because I'd missed something. And I just was watching my feet move, not noting, just watching, filling my awareness with the movements in the feet. And it was so beautiful, so nice. And it was a natural. It was naturally slow. Sometimes that happens to you. And that's how slow it can become. And I always remember on one occasion, I'd obviously lost complete track of time and didn't really remember I was supposed to go to a dharana that morning. So I was missing. And so they decided to try and find me. They sent a couple of monks over to look for me. And they found me outside the hall during my walking meditation. And one of the monks came up to me and said, Brahma Wangsa, you've got to come for dharana. My eyes were about 2 meters in front of me. And I was just so busy watching my feet. When he said that, it was as if he was right next to my ear. It was like he was 100 miles away. You can only just hear him. Brahma Wangsa, dharana. That's how I heard it. And so he had to say it again, louder, right in my ear, Brahma Wangsa, dharana. And I realized that I'd forgotten. And I had to come out of samadhi. And I always remember that I was looking down. He was standing next to me. And I had to move my head like this. Because as I started moving my head, I became aware of all the sensations in my head. I just couldn't move fast. There was just too much going on. It took me a minute to face him and say, what? Fortunately, he was a monk. He knew I wasn't crazy. Just what happens when you get peaceful. You just can't go fast. It's a natural quietness, a natural slowness. And I really enjoyed that walking meditation. The walking meditation and the sitting meditation, they came together. The one just melted seamlessly into the other. It was all just doing exactly the same thing, but doing it while I was walking rather than I was sitting. I even learned how to do sleeping meditation. Sleeping meditation is very good. I call it meditating flat out. You're flat out. Flat out also means giving it everything you've got. So when you're doing sleeping meditation, you're lying down. If you're doing sleeping meditation or lying down meditation rather than sleeping, try and lay down in a posture in which you don't normally sleep. Because if you lay down in the same position where you normally go to sleep, your brain will get confused. All the messages coming to it was saying, this is the position in which I usually fall asleep. Now she wants me to be awake. The brain doesn't know what to do and usually goes for sleep instead of being awake. If you do lying down meditation in a posture, in a position where you normally go to sleep, you'll find it's very difficult to do. So try a different posture than what you normally do to go to sleep. If you normally go to sleep on your back, then meditate on your side. If you normally go to sleep on your side, then meditate on your back. However it is, something different, just to make sure the brain doesn't get confused. It knows, she wants me to meditate now. She doesn't want me to sleep. When the Buddha did lying down meditation, he always did lying down and sleeping on his right side. But when he was sleeping, he would fold his arm underneath his body like this. When he was meditating, he'd push it out to raise his head up above the floor. You've probably seen statues of the Buddha meditating like that. Just that difference was enough to make his mind know that this was not sleeping time, but meditating time. It's good to learn that, to learn how to meditate in a lying down posture. Because you'll probably go out of samsara, certainly you go out of this life, not in a sitting posture. You won't go out of this life walking. Most people go out of this life, they die in the lying down posture. So if you can learn how to do meditation in that lying down posture, then you'll know how to meditate when you're sick, and especially just before you die. You've got used to it, and the mind knows how to make itself peaceful and clear at the time of your last sickness. Not only that, but sometimes when you get older and your body is not as supple as before, just when things start to go rusty and they start to creak, when things, the screws, they don't turn as much as they used to, when everything creaks and aches as you get older and older and older, sometimes it's hard to sit cross-legged on the floor. Even the Buddha had such things as bad backs. Your body wears out, that's its nature. So sometimes being able to do lying down meditation in the most comfortable position of the body can be very, very helpful. As is sitting down on a chair meditation, as you see I've allowed here today. Much of your life these days you sit down on a chair. So it means that at any time, if you know how to meditate sitting in a chair, you can be on a bus going to KL. You can be in the back of a car being taken somewhere. You can be in an aircraft traveling from one city to the next. You know, because you've trained yourself to meditate in a chair, how to get peaceful when you're sitting. These are great skills for our modern life. So those of you who've been sitting in a chair, you've gained something that those people sitting on a chair haven't gained. The ability to meditate in another type of posture, which you can make use of even in the time you're at work. I'll mention how you can make use of meditation in the lay life at work, at home, later on this afternoon. But there are also other meditations which we can make use of, such as the meditation on loving kindness. And I think I might do a short loving kindness meditation later on. The loving kindness meditation is so similar to walking meditation and also breath meditation. All it is focus instead on the breath, instead on the movement of the feet. Focus on that thing which we call compassion, kindness, love. Again, like every other meditation, you have to start focusing your mind in the present moment awareness and silence, first of all, just to calm the mind down, to establish mindfulness in front of you, as the Buddha kept on saying. Once you have basic mindfulness in front of you, then whatever object you take up, you can focus on and keep long enough for the object to do its work. In loving kindness meditation, I always encourage people to choose an object which they find very easy to generate feelings of love and kindness towards. Personally, I use an imaginary kitten. I visualize a kitten because I like cats. You might like dogs or babies. One of my students in Sydney, even though she was a woman, she hated babies. She disliked cats, and she certainly didn't like dogs. So she had to find some sort of object which she loved and cared for. She was very innovative. She lived in an apartment in one of the inner suburbs of Sydney. In her apartment, on her window, she had a box of plants, which she was very caring of. That's the only thing she really looked after. And so, very skillfully, when she started doing loving kindness meditation, she imagined one of her plants in front of her. And she imagined caring for it, watering for it, tending it. And all her feelings, I was going to call them womanly, but they're manly as well, all her feelings of nurturing, tenderness, kindness, loving kindness, she started generating on a small plant, first of all. The point is, with developing loving kindness meditation, it does not matter how you start. The important thing is you start on something which is easy to generate feelings of love, kindness, warmth towards. Because loving kindness has always been described like a fire, like an energy. And if you're starting a fire, you'll always start using things which easily take the flame, like paper. When anyone starts a fire, they start with some paper, some newspaper usually, and then they add a match to that. And then they put twigs on top of that paper, and then slightly thicker pieces of wood. When the kindling has taken the flame, only then do you put on the big sticks. And only when the big sticks have taken the fire, only then do you put on the logs. Only when the big logs have taken the fire, only then the big sappy logs, the wet stuff. Because if you've got a roaring fire, even wet, sappy logs soon get dried out, and they too burn. Everything burns given enough heat, even your enemies. You start with something easy, like a kitten, like a plant, like you're the person in the world who you love the most, you care for the most. And from that, you develop the first feelings of love and kindness. In loving kindness meditation, these objects are just tools to develop the awareness of what metta love really means. So once you have developed enough care, love, kindness towards this imaginary being, then you look inside your heart and feel, what's it like? What does kindness, compassion really feel like as an emotional sensation centered in your body? Because that's what you're generating, not the thoughts, the feeling of love, the feeling of metta. And every now and again you go back to that, notice it, and you go back to the the object, kindling some more warmth on that. When there's enough energy of loving kindness inside your heart, then you can swap objects from the paper to the kindling. Another person who you care for in this world. And you develop even more feelings of love and warmth. Then you put the bigger twigs on, other people. When the fire of loving kindness is really strong, and only when it's really strong, you can remember your enemies, the wet, sappy logs. And you'll be surprised at yourself when you have that degree of loving kindness that's so strong inside of you. It doesn't matter, even your enemies, you forgive easy. The wetness dries out, and they are soon take the fire of your love and kindness. You build up metta. People who start to develop loving kindness towards their enemies straight away, they will never be able to do it. When I was over in Thailand, we used to start this chant, may all beings be happy and well. We used to start developing loving kindness like that. I found it so difficult. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. I started chanting, because I was rebellious. I started chanting, may all beings except mosquitoes be happy and well. But there's no way I'm going to let those mosquitoes be happy and well. What they were doing to me, they didn't deserve happiness and well-being. They were taking advantage of me being a monk that I couldn't kill them. And that's what sometimes we do. May all beings be happy and well except my husband. May all beings be happy and well except that boss at work who gives me such a hard time. May all beings be happy and well except Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden or whoever else you hate in the world. Now that, you can't do loving kindness that way. Because as soon as you say accept, 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 it's not unconditional anymore. So you have to start with the easy things. Start with someone who's so easy to develop loving kindness towards.
even an imaginary person, even a plant. You build it up. Just like in breath meditation, you build up the energy of stillness. Here you're building up the energy of love. And then when it gets very strong, you can zap anyone with loving kindness. So easy to do. But you've got to be careful. What I said the other night, or said to the interview somewhere, I was once doing loving kindness meditation on a beach to the south of Perth. Had an afternoon off. I was going to the prison later that evening. And I was really getting into loving kindness meditation. Just before I started, I saw this young man and young woman. They were walking past me, not holding hands or anything. They're just walking past me, that's all. And just as I closed my eyes, and I started in loving kindness, really blissing out, may all beings be happy and well, really strong, you know, metta. Only about 20 minutes or half an hour, when I opened my eyes, that couple had only moved about 5 meters away from me. When I looked at them, they were in the most passionate of embraces. They were kissing and hugging each other like nothing. I realized my loving kindness had gone to them first of all, and they'd misinterpreted it and not understood what loving kindness truly is. Oops. So there is a danger of loving kindness that way. But it just shows you the power, something which you can do. And it not only, this is actually the most important part of loving kindness, it's not just by giving other people happiness. Because when you go back and feel, what does this feel like inside of me? You start to feel this amazing, beautiful feeling inside, the feeling, the sensation of loving kindness. And that's where you take away the crutch of objects such as people and beings. That's where you feel what loving kindness actually is, when it's not directed at anybody, when it just is. You feel it in your heart, this beautiful warmth, this light, this power inside of you, the power of love, without it going anywhere. You know what happens next? That feeling, that sensation, that beautiful, very blissful feeling of love, almost immediately turns into this golden limiter, that is golden light in front of your mind. Because it's made of love, it is so beautiful and so attractive. You have got to the stage of nimittas, just through doing loving kindness. When that golden light appears in front of your face, do nothing. Don't go spreading anything anywhere. And you will fall into that light, and you gain a jhana that way. If you go into jhana through loving kindness, when you come out afterwards, my goodness, you will have all that loving kindness left. So powerful. But I tell people, you can zap anybody. I say zap because I used to read comics as a kid. But that's what it's like. You have power. You look at someone, zap. And they feel it. My goodness, whoa. They're very warm and beautiful feeling. You have superpower. This is no comic story. This is how it happens. And that's how you find that some people have huge amounts of loving kindness. You come into their presence and my goodness, you feel good. You feel so safe, you feel warm. And that's how you can really spread loving kindness to others. It's called a metta jhana, just because that's the way it goes in. Inside the jhana is exactly the same. So loving kindness is a beautiful meditation for many people. So if the breath doesn't work, try some loving kindness. Or even better, try both. At the same time, the door of my heart is open to the breath. You care for the breath. You have loving kindness towards the breath. First time I tried that, you're always innovative. Try things new. I got amazing meditations. Even at night time, I was dreaming I was in deep meditation. When I came out, I was in deep meditation. It was great fun doing loving kindness on the breath. It's just so easy to do. Just, you know, watching the breath with kindness. Really developing all that metta, that energy of warmth onto your breath. Oh, my goodness, that's powerful. So you can do all these meditations. The last meditation, haven't got really much time, is doing the death meditation. Don't be afraid of, I will die that for sure, I will die that for sure. It really is good fun. People laugh at it and you say what you're doing and say, I will die that for sure. They really think you're weird and strange. They think that you should go to a psychologist, psychiatrist, as sooner the better. Because it goes against the way of the world.
And I like being rebellious and going against the way of the world. I was given a psychology test, I think the Massachusetts Institute of Technology psychology test when I was first a monk. The person who gave it to me, they wanted to find out just, you know, how sane monks were. And I realized that I made a mistake, or rather, I did an answer which would really count it heavily against me. When the question said, "Do you lie?" I said, "No." If you say that in a psychology test, you really get, you know, 10 minus marks. Because they assume that everyone lies. So if you say you don't lie, you are just in denial. You're lying that you don't lie. That's what they assume in psychology. That's why psychologists don't really understand what they're doing. That's why most psychologists have to have therapists. But anyhow, so that I will die, that's for sure. People might think it's weird, but it does a wonderful thing. What it does, it makes you more free in life. You're going to die anyway, so what's the point of attaching? It puts things in perspective. You understand what's really important in life instead of rushing around for things which aren't so important. You know what happens? Anyone who has a close shave with death always comes back afterwards with different priorities in life. This happened to one of my friends who was a businessman in Sydney. He went for his medical examination, just a yearly checkup. No, nothing really wrong, just routine. But a few days later, his doctor, who was a personal friend, rang him up at home. The first question the doctor asked was, "Is your wife there?" The way the doctor asked the question and the type of question rang many alarm bells for that businessman. Why would the doctor say the first thing, "Is your wife at home?" when he wants to talk to me? And why that tone of voice? Straight away he figured out what the problem was and asked the doctor, "What's up?" And the doctor said, "I don't like telling you this, but the results have come back from the lab of your blood test. They've found a cancer in your blood. It's a very rare form of cancer. Unfortunately, it's untreatable. And it's very far advanced." And of course, he asked the question which everyone asks, "How long?" And the doctor said, "No one can tell, but it won't be more than 3 or 4 months. And that was a shock to this friend of mine, this businessman. This is a true story, don't make this up. It was a great shock to him, because he felt so healthy. It was as if nothing was wrong with him. Sometimes that happens to people. 1 minute they seem so healthy, so alive. The next minute they go to the doctor, another week they're dead. I've seen many people like that. And there he was, told by his doctor, he got some sort of rare blood cancer. He took it quite well. He talked it over with his family, with his wife and children. Being a businessman, he never had time for his family. He'd been promising them for years to take them to Europe, as many people in Australia like to do. Now, he took them there. He decided to sell his business. And he wasn't really worried too much about the price. He actually got a reasonable price, so he said. He sold his business within a few days. He bought first-class tickets, aircraft, best hotels, for him, his wife and his 2 children, to go on the last trip of a lifetime together to Europe. He had the tickets in his hand about a week or two later when the doctor rang again. "I don't know how to tell you this. There have been 2 patients with the same surname. It's a mix-up, you're perfectly healthy." He was perfectly healthy. People do make mistakes, so it can happen, it does happen. And they sent the wrong results to the wrong place. He was healthy. He never sued that doctor. He never got angry at that doctor. He calls that doctor one of his best friends. He went on that trip to Europe, had a wonderful time. And then when he came back, he bought a small business with the money left over. Still making money, but this time enjoying life much, much more. That experience told him the meaning of life. What's really important in life? Rather than chasing money, Sometimes when you come that close to death, such things don't make any sense anymore. Many of your cravings and attachments just completely fade away, the meaningless ones. When you say, I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. That's why it's a good practice in meditation. It lets go of those things which don't really matter. And it keeps those things which are really important. That's why we do death meditation, to enhance our lives, not to make ourselves miserable or morbid. People who do that death meditation don't become depressed. In fact, they become more alive. It seems to be, don't make sense. If you keep thinking about death all the time, won't you sort of just give up and get depressed and stay in your bed and just die before your time? No, 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 no. What really happens when you understand about death? You understand about the importance of life. The importance of the time you have. When you realize that this meditation retreat is going to end in a short time, it means you value the time you've got left here. You don't waste a moment of it. This thing is going to be over before you know it. So enjoy it while you have the chance. This life of yours is going to be over before you know it. You started this retreat, it was only seemed a few moments ago, yesterday sometimes. It goes so fast. Soon it's going to be over. Your life started only yesterday, it seemed. Only a short time ago you were in school, getting married, getting your first job. And now look at you. It goes so fast. So because we know that soon we will also die, therefore we know what's important in life. And when we know what's important in life, then we live that importance to the full. So death meditation just makes you alive. It makes you kind. It makes you peaceful. It reorganizes your priorities in life, which is what it's supposed to do. It's called making wisdom. So those are some of the different meditation objects which we have. All following that path which I began with, of starting out of faith, we get joy. The path is joyful, which leads to, from faith we get delight, from delight we get joy, from joy we get tranquility, peace, at least in the body. And from tranquility we get happiness, from happiness we get samadhi, the peace in the mind. From peace in the mind we see things as they truly are. And seeing things as they truly are, all our attachments fade away, disappear, cease. We become enlightened. The natural process. Whether it's breath meditation, whether it's walking meditation, whether it's loving kindness meditation, whether it's meditation on death, they're all going in the same direction. They all give rise to peace and happiness and freedom. So please, enjoy this meditation. If you get bored doing one, do another. So you've got many little things you can entertain the mind. I will die, that's for sure. Make out your own words. Or, you know, loving kindness, may all beings be happy and well. May all mosquitoes be happy and well. May all computers be happy and well. Anything which irritates you, may the whole life be happy and well. Whatever it is, giving loving kindness and care. It brightens the mind. It's going in the right direction. In summary, you know it's going in the right direction if it gives rise to peace, to freedom, to happiness, to joy. Then you know it's the teaching of the Buddha. It's the Dharma of the Enlightened One. Okay, so that's the morning instruction to brighten up the meditation with a bit of variety. Okay, are there any questions on that before I go down for the interviews? Yeah? Yeah, because upeka means looking on, because the best part of upeka actually happens in and after the fourth jhana. That's called the purity of upeka, because after a fourth jhana you're just so still, so powerfully still. Whatever you look on, you just look on it. You don't move. And because you're just looking on it, you look into it. Deeply, 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 deeply. It's not so much indifference. Some people mistake upeka with indifference. Just, no, I'm not really worried about this. Upeka is more powerful than indifference. It's an incredible bright state of mind. We can just see something. without doing anything at all. It's an observance, a mindfulness complete with letting go. Full of letting go. Incredible mindfulness, powerful mindfulness, but just watching, not driving, not doing anything. Not complaining, not wanting. Yeah? Ah, it's a very good question. Yeah. When you actually want to go to sleep rather than meditate lying down, then lie down in your normal posture where you usually fall asleep, because then the mind will know, okay, she wants me to go to sleep now. The posture, psychology is very important. You know, if you put yourself in a certain position, the mind knows you're supposed to be doing something in this position. You know, if like in martial arts, if you put yourself in a certain position, the mind knows you're going to fight or you're going to defend. Body language has a mental counterpart. So first of all, lie down in the position in which you normally go to sleep. You can raise a bit of mindfulness by just doing present moment awareness. So you're not really wondering about what you're going to happen after you wake up. You're not carrying the past into your sleep with you. Your present moment, you're here now. And try and get some silence. So you're not thinking out the problems of the day. Nor are you thinking of the future. You're no thinking at all. Just be. Especially those of you who have a hard time sleeping, let go of the thought, I want to go to sleep. I have to go to sleep. If I don't go to sleep soon, I'm going to have to get up early. I'm going to be so tired. Quick, go to sleep. Quick. Those sorts of thoughts is what keeps you awake. So you lie down there, present moment, make the mind still, no desire, be kind. And then the mind is still enough, relaxed enough to go to fall asleep. Have you got children? Have you ever gone to your child's bedroom at night when it can't sleep and soothe it to sleep? If your child is sleepless, do you ever take it by the throat, throttle it and say, go to sleep, you monster, go to sleep? What would happen if you did that to your child? Would it go to sleep? It would get so excited, so wound up, it wouldn't go to sleep for hours. Now, do you understand why some people find it hard to go to sleep? That's what they do to themselves. Metaphorically, they grab themselves by the throat, go to sleep, you've got to go to sleep. Like throttling a child. When you go to see your child and you want to get it to go to sleep, you stroke its hair. Be so kind. It's alright. Mummy's here. Go to sleep. Tell a little story. Be so kind to the baby or to the child. It soon goes to sleep. That's how you should go to sleep. Not only with your real hand, but your psychological hand. There, it's alright. Mummy's here. You're alright. Ajahn Brahm's here. The Buddha's here. It's all safe. I've told you many stories, many bedtime stories at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. There we go. When you soothe yourself like that and very gentle and kind, you treat yourself like a child when you're putting yourself to bed at night. Then you always sleep well. So that's how you do sleeping meditation. Then you can sleep efficiently. So many people don't sleep well. And it creates great problems with your health and with your happiness, with your efficiency at work and in life. You get grumpy when you get up in the morning. So learn how to sleep. Sleep efficiently. Sleep kindly. Sleep peacefully. Okay, I think that's enough questions now because it's interview time, the last interviews. So those of you who've got the merit have got down on the board, you can actually come for the interviews. If you're not on the board, I shouldn't say this, I say you can go and talk to someone who's on the board, and make them an offer. No, don't do that. Okay, so interview time, and then we have lunch at 11 o'clock. Is there any announcements for what happens afterwards? Is it according to the program? It's clean up afterwards? And then, announcement made at lunch. There may be a special announcement, but because of what a wonderful retreat it is, we're extending it for 2 weeks. Who knows what might happen?